Welcome to Microbyte. My name is Gavin Clark, software editor for the Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of the ZDNet All About Microsoft blog.
8.5 billion. It'll buy you a heck of a lot, or it can buy you very little. In Microsoft's case, it bought them Skype. We'll be looking at the good, the bad, and the ridiculous behind the largest ever deal in Microsoft's history. There's been a reorg, aren't there always, inside Microsoft? Only this time, it affects the Azure cloud. Will the red shirts and the red shoes mix? We're not sure they will. And tech heads in town will be asking, or will be looking at, what Microsoft should be talking about. And maybe it should be talking a little more about the Azure appliance, which still hasn't materialized. So, it's been a busy year so far. Just when we thought we'd seen it all, with Bob Muglia leaving, and we'd seen Windows on ARM. Here they go. They went and pulled out this one for us. The largest deal in Microsoft's history, 8.5 billion for a very well-known but still tiny and loss-making web telco company called Skype that eBay didn't want to own and actually got rid of at one point. So what exactly has Steve Ballmer bought? What has he landed himself in here? I'm pretty sure, looking at the reaction from the acquisition, it wasn't what Steve Ballmer anticipated. Microsoft stock didn't move anywhere. It moved down a little bit on the Newsland deal, which basically said that the Wall Street traders don't understand the deal and can't see the rationale for it, especially in 8.5 billion. Taking a quick look inside Microsoft, at least one Microsoft blogger, Mini Microsoft, who we all follow, he's had his finger on the pulse of Microsoft, and a lot of the guys, the Microsofters who comment on his blog as well, gave their feelings. They were scratching their heads. They see it as a way to wipe out shareholder value. And in fact, many of the supposed pluses of the deal, such as integration of Skype with Xbox, for example, that is, they already have that stuff through Xbox. You can already do video conferencing on Xbox Live. So it's not entirely clear what's going on there. Also, Microsoft really has a heck of a lot of web properties that it could theoretically utilize. Let me backtrack there, because one of the big USB of the deal, reading between the lines, was advertising, and that's something Steve Ballmer kept talking about. There was the synergy. Well, not, so you can use the word synergies, but I will, because I've been in the Silicon Valley for a little too long now. The synergies of advertising, of selling more ads against two people, and the people in this case are the 170 million and growing, we're told, Skype customers, and I use the customer in quote marks because they're not actually paying for anything, they're actually users. They often use a service for free. About 40% of those people are actually using the video conference, part of the videoing aspect of Skype. And so we're told, Steve said in the press conference in San Francisco on Tuesday, that they reckon that video advertising, I think he said video advertising, will grow by about 45% compound annual growth rate during the next few years. Clearly, this is a deal to give Microsoft another group of users who it can sell online advertising to. And Tony Bates, who's the CEO of Skype, was talking about how the company had already been doing a lot of work to develop so-called rich immersive experiences when it came to advertising. So you can imagine that Microsoft would accelerate more things like offers, giveaways, you know, teaser deals, the things you have to click through and wade through. So is it worth spending 8.5 billion for a company that's a loss maker that nobody wanted? It's a curious deal, I think, because as it turned out that 8.5 billion was not a bidding war. 8.5 billion was Steve Ballmer going to the companies that own Skype, who actually have a large stake in it, which are eBay, Silver Lake Partners, and Andreessen and Horowitz, and the Canadian Pensions Board, who all had stakes in the company. And who we're told wanted at least $7 billion in return for owning the company. Turns out Steve wasn't going to take that lying down, so he offered him $8.5 billion, and he did that in the knowledge that nobody else was bidding for Skype whatsoever. It's a curious deal to get. It's a curious turn of events when the CEO of the world's largest software company walks into a non-contested bidding situation and offers the owners of the company more than they would have accepted in the first place.
I know. I got to say, that's the part of this whole story that to me is so odd. I mean, okay, if you realize like you're not in a bidding war with someone, you don't high bid it, you low bid it, mm-hmm. right?
I use this phrase. I use Will Mount say very guardedly, and I don't like to do it because, you know, we're not privy to negotiations. We haven't seen the numbers, and, you know, history might prove us wrong. But I have to say, having covered Microsoft for a long time, this for me calls into question Steve Ballmer's judgment, and it calls into question his negotiating skills. And he's a salesman, and he will come into this room and he could out negotiate me on something. I don't doubt that whatsoever. But it seems to me he got out negotiated here by the venture capitalists of Silicon Valley, who spent $1.9 billion on this company and have made six. Is it more than they're actually getting 8.5 back? But if you take out the money they paid, they're actually getting about $6.6 billion back between them. And that six, I think, that goes to the VCs. It might go to eBay as well. That's a lot of people. And ironically, we might know. I actually wrote this week. One of those VCs is Mark Andreessen, whose company Netscape Microsoft killed during the browser wars, the 90s.
Exactly. So, wouldn't that make you nervous? Say you're the guy in the room negotiating with a guy whose company you killed. And he's telling you, have I got a deal for you. I'm sure it had to cross his mind, like, is this the ultimate Netscape revenge, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, so the other kind of weird piece to this, which All Things D reported, actually, and it was when I saw this, it was another one of those disconnects for me, was supposedly the person who negotiated the deal with Ballmer was Charles Songhurst, who works at Microsoft as an M&A specialist. Mm-hmm. Charles Songhurst's bio on Microsoft's site says he takes credit for killing Microsoft's attempt to buy Yahoo. Okay, so here's a guy who's got some rational sense to him, right? Mm. But he does this deal. So what did he see in this deal that they didn't see in the Yahoo deal? I mean, because there's a lot of comparable things between these two deals other than the huge size of the Yahoo deal. But, I mean, Microsoft buying technology it already had. Mm-hmm. So what did Songhurst see in Skype that he didn't see in Yahoo? That was going to be my question if we were allowed to ask any questions, which we weren't.
No.
So.
It's curious. I can see that seeing Silicon Valley, I've seen this pitch, I've heard this pitch so many times about, it's about the customers, it's about the user base they've got that you can monetize, and it's about the potential growth. And it's interesting to note that I think it's Ben Horowitz, who is Mark Andreessen's partner, who is also his colleague from the Netscape days, blogged that day congratulating Microsoft on what he called smart play.
I know, I saw that.
And he said, you know, that more or less he said, this is now down to the execution. It's down to the execution. Microsoft has everything in place to do this well. I'm paraphrasing wildly here. But if you read the blog, you'll see what he said. More or less what he's saying, the takeaway is, this is a theory. The theory is, there are 170 million users of Skype. The theory is you can sell them more adverts. The theory is you can make this much return on those adverts. That's the theory. Now go make it work. Mm-hmm. Microsoft has bought into that. Microsoft has been sold a theory, it seems to me, having heard these fireside pitches so many times, and in the belief that yes, they can do it. Did they want the brand? Did they want the Skype brand? I mean, Steve Ballmer noted how, that's a separate discussion. You noticed how Skype is a verb. They've been jonesing for a verb ever since they came up with Bing, and they're failing there because no one says they're going to Bing something on the web. They still say they're going to Google it. You know, slightly facetious comments, but in telling they actually mentioned it's a verb. They've made $8.5 billion for a verb, it seems, and a theory of advertising that's not materialized. I don't get it. I really don't get it. It's a curious one. So I know, the one thing I could possibly see this working, but I would still caveat by saying that, was it worth $8.5 billion, was the ability to sell more licenses for Link Server and for Outlook and Exchange. Because if as I know, that some small businesses do use Skype rather than pay for the carrier for the phone service, and because it's free, if you can tie Skype into your integrated communications server, into the same email inbox as Outlook, etc., and the voicemail box that's running your phone, your PBX, that Outlook and Link ties into. There's a justification there, but 8.5 billion to sell more copies of Office, to sell more versions of Outlook, to sell more copies of Exchange Server. That's kind of curious.
You know, one crazy thing that I've had a couple of my readers suggest, and at first I was like, that's crazy, but the more I think about it, the more I wonder if Skype could potentially be the replacement for Windows Live Messenger.
Yeah.
Because Live Messenger, they've been kind of neglecting it lately, even though it has like hundreds of millions of users worldwide. Like they, when Windows Phone 7 came out, it didn't even have a Messenger client from Microsoft. It had a Messenger client from a company called Miawa. Mm-hmm. And most of the Windows Phone 7 users I've talked to hate it. And they were just stunned. Like, how could Microsoft not have done its own IM client for its own phone? And so the rumor was that Microsoft was going to integrate Live Messenger into Mango, the upcoming release of Windows Phone that's due later this year. But what if, just think theoretically, what if the idea was they had already been pulling back from investing new resources in Live Messenger, which, by the way, can do a lot of this video conferencing kind of stuff also. And instead they're thinking, what if we made Skype our unified communications client?
It's possible. It's a good theory. I'm interested about why they had to buy the company rather than partner.
I know. Yeah, that's what I keep coming back to. Like, why couldn't you just partner with Skype? I mean, was somebody telling them that Google or Cisco was going to buy Skype and they don't want to admit that? I mean, there's just so many pieces of this thing that don't add up. Yeah. And I feel like Microsoft would have had more appreciation and love for the deal if they could have said to the public, you know, we knew Google was about to buy it for $7 billion, so we said, okay, look, we've got to outbid them because it's something we can't let Google have.
Yeah.
Or Cisco or Facebook. But instead, the story they're telling is, no, nobody wanted it, and we wanted it. there's just so many pieces that make you go, huh, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's look at the other interesting aspect here. The ring fencing of Skype inside Microsoft. This is the first deal in Microsoft's history where the product, the company it's bought, is not going to be folded into an existing company division. It's going to become a separate division, and Tony Bates is going to become president of that group and report into Steve Ballmer. Now, that's interesting because they've completely broken with precedent on that, which it says a lot about the deal itself. It says a lot to me. It says the reason for that, I think, is to help the company, it's essentially to own the company at arm's length and not allow the Microsoft agenda to creep in and spoil the product roadmap or the brand. And I say that because Ballmer was keen to stress that Microsoft will continue the cross-platform development of Skype and won't become skewed towards Windows. Which, you know, unfortunately it will. If they want to integrate it with Xbox and Kinect and Office and all the other properties, they said, it's inevitable, it will happen. This will happen over time. The question is how far do the other clients keep up or move in parity? I wonder, to me, it seems logical. It seems to me to stop that daily creep getting sucked into the Windows orbit for Skype, to keep it as a separate product unit reporting to one person, Steve Ballmer. That's the only reason. That says how much is at stake in this thing by keeping it separate. And in many ways, it reminds me of when Sun Microsystems bought MySQL, and they kept that as a separate product, ring-fenced product unit within Sun, rather than have the Sun engineers and the marketing and product people invade Skype and invade MySQL, the MySQL people be kind of like sucked off into the rest of Sun, and over time the product became a shell of what it used to be, as did the brand.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the other question is, if they didn't do that, if they didn't ring fence, I love that word, where would they have put it?
Yeah.
Because if they put Skype inside of the Windows and Windows Live division, you can already see what would happen there. It would just get sucked into a black hole, you know? Yeah. I mean, because the Windows and Windows Live division, a lot of people already feel like Windows Live gets way short shrift and not enough attention because it's Windows, you know. If you put it in online services, that's just a money pit, right? Everything people talk about when they talk about Microsoft Online Services is how much money they're losing in that division. if you put it in with Xbox, you know, then how would any of the technologies from Skype make it over the wall into the business side of the house? You know, how would they end up in Office, or how would they end up in Link? Because I can tell you, I'm seriously doubtful the Link team talks a whole lot to Xbox Live. I know they talk a little bit to them because they're working on that Xbox Live Avatar Connect thing. Yeah. But it's not two teams that have a lot to do with each other. So in a way, there wasn't a natural home for it anywhere inside Microsoft either. And also the whole fact that it's going to continue to be an entity that does cross-platform support. They're going to keep doing iPhone and Android and iOS. You know, there aren't very many divisions in Microsoft where that's a priority.
Yeah.
So I think they kind of had to put it in its own division. They didn't have anywhere else they could put it.
My question is, how long does this last? Steve Ballmer made a personal commitment to continue the cross-platform development. But we know how personal commitments go, but he may have his way, so it may seem like this is a personal thing. But the other thing was, like, we know how often reorganizations happen inside Microsoft, at least once a year. And the priorities are always shifting. Because it's not something where they set down a five-year plan and nothing changes in the march towards that five-year plan. And then there's another reorg to march towards the next five-year plan. So I wonder what it'll take for Skype to eventually go, listen, this separate Skype unit thing is not working, or I can see a reason for putting the people in all these other units, like you said, like put some of them in Xbox, put some of them in the Office division, because the Office division is not what it used to be right now. It's not the business applications group. It's been sort of eviscerated slightly. It's just an Office unit right now. Steve's running the business applications side of it again. So the Microsoft corporate structure is in a huge state of flux right now. If this has been bought, if they bought Skype, say maybe I think 2 years ago, when the existing five product units still existed, there could have been a case for, I can see where it would fit, or it can get folded in maybe. But right now, the Microsoft's corporate structure has never been in so much flux because I think they're missing two group presidents, I believe, at last count. Certainly, two groups have been broken up as such, not in a physical destructive act, but they've been disassembled and they're in the process of being reassembled, it seems, under new presidents. So at what point does the separate Skype unit finally, eventually, one day in the future, get folded back in? And what the tipping point for that would be, kind of mentally and intellectually and in terms of business terms?
Yep, good question. We don't know any of those answers. And, you know, Microsoft said repeatedly this week, we can't tell you any more details or promise anything further or give you a roadmap until we get regulatory clearance. So that's another whole set of issues, right? Is anybody going to try to stand in the way of this? Is Google or Cisco or anyone going to try to complain on antitrust grounds about the acquisition?
Yeah, definitely. Well, as Steve said, and I think we're saying it for entirely different sentiments, interesting times.
Yes. Exciting times.
Exciting times, Steve. Exciting.
Yes.
Exciting,
yes.
Indeed. Well, let's move on.
Yes, we're talking about reorgs.
Reorgs, yes. Before this week's big news, there was big news last week as well.
There was.
MJ, do you want to handle some of that?
Yeah. So we had been hearing some kind of confusing and odd rumors about Scott Guthrie, you know, the corporate vice president who runs .NET and the .NET engineering team, the Silverlight engineering team, and all that good stuff, going to Azure. And it was funny, when I first reported the rumor that I heard about this, I get so many emails and tweets and notes from people saying, no way, you are wrong. This is stupid. I can't believe you think this is going to happen.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool when it happened. It's fun to be right.
Yeah.
But still, I'm still scratching my head. So here's what happened. They had a reorg in the server and tool business, which got announced publicly on May 2nd. Well, it didn't actually get announced publicly. It got announced internally. But people sent me copies of the memo, so I saw what had happened. And the biggest and most interesting change to me out of all the different people who got moved around and changed in title and all that was Scott Guthrie. So Scott Guthrie's new title is Corporate Vice President of the Azure Application Platform Team. So that's a team that didn't exist before. He's going to be working for Ted Kummert, who works inside of the Server and Tools division already. And he's going to – Scott Guthrie's still going to have a lot of the people reporting to him who were before. So like the ASP.NET team, the information services team, and all those folks are moving with him to this new group called Azure Application Platform. So first question, what is the Azure Application Platform and why did they think they needed to do this? You know, there's been a lot of rumor about Microsoft's Azure strategy being kind of lacking in terms of offering a clear and cohesive developer story. And I think that's part of the reason they probably put Guthrie in there. They realize they, you know, the people who are the biggest customer set and the main people they're reaching out to with Windows Azure are developers. They're trying to get you to develop new applications or move your old applications onto Azure so that you have a cloud-hosted platform on Microsoft's stack. But if you don't have a really good developer story, you know, with a cohesive set of tools, methodologies, advantages over other platforms, I think you don't really have a good way to get customers. And all we know from Microsoft is they say they've got 31,000 Azure customers. We don't know how many are paying. We don't know how many are Microsoft customers, actually people who work at Microsoft, I mean. And so I think every time I talk to developers, they're like, yeah, I don't really know what their tool strategy is. Or, I want to use PHP. I want to use Perl. I want to use Ruby. And they kind of support it, but not really. Or I don't see why I should pay for Azure when I can just go, you know, use Amazon's cloud and I don't have to get all this other stuff sold to me that's like a platform. So my thinking is they're going to have Guthrie try to make the advantage of Microsoft's platform as a service more clear and win over more developers because he's the guy at Microsoft who developers love. I mean, they even wear red polo shirts to try to be like him. Don't they?
Yes, they do. There's a slightly weird homoerotic thing going on every time he comes on stage. You notice all the posters they use of him in the screen grabs they use, and everyone gets all kind of giggly when he's on stage, even the other Microsoft execs. There's a bit of Guthrie love going on inside the company. It's
there
strange.
Is. There is.
But having said that, he's a very nice man. We've met many times. And what is curious to me, based on what you just said, is that that sounds very much like a marketing communications role. His bread and butter is pure technology. I mean, the guy helped build. I mean, he didn't conceive, and he didn't like try and sell. He helped build .NET.
Yeah.
He helped come up with C# and CLI. I mean, this guy knows his shit. He created this stuff.
Right.
So it says to me that he's not just going to go, or pretend, two things. Either he's going to help, he's going to help architect some Visual Studio related Azure development framework, or they're going to hope that they can trade his past credibility to help sell what they've got already and go, hey, Scott recommends this, therefore it's good for you. That's the thing that's not clear to me. Now, if it's the latter, I've seen this kind of thing happen like with other companies. I remember Todd Nielsen, when he left Microsoft and he was lauded, he went to Oracle, then he went to BEA, and now he's currently using VMware. Never kind of reprised the success that he had at Microsoft, who he was the godfather of the MSDN network. We never saw him relive those kind of glory days. Now, I'm not saying Scott's the same or that his job is the same, but can the guy who came up with helped come up with .NET, can he evangelize on a scale that Microsoft seems to be suggesting that they think he can do? I don't know.
I know. Yeah, I mean, all of those are really good questions. And also the other set of questions that I've been getting since this came to light was, so what happens to Silverlight?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, since he was running the Silverlight developer team, that's a very valid question to ask. And Microsoft's still got people in place who are going to run it. Somebody who I don't know and whose name is escaping me right now is going to run the Silverlight team and continue to work on the Silverlight strategy, you know, Silverlight being a development environment, not clear what it means for Silverlight being a cross-platform runtime, if that's still going to go forward in any capacity, although that was kind of a dwindling message even before they moved Scott over. Mm-hmm. But the back to where he is now, the business platform division. So what that division is in charge of right now before Scott comes over there is SQL Server, SQL Azure, BizTalk Server, Windows Server App Fabric, and Windows Azure App Fabric. So if you think about all those things, what those are, I mean, those are all kind of like the crux of the building blocks that Microsoft's putting on top of Azure. So I guess you put Mix Guthrie in there, and you have a very interesting private cloud kind of play, because mm-hmm. a lot of those things, SQL Server, App Fabric, BizTalk Server, those are kind of Microsoft's building blocks for the private cloud. I don't know what it gets you for the public cloud.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think they know I know they need to do more work on tools to build cloud. Let's call them cloud. It's such a used phrase. Let's just say tools to build cloud applications. The kind of more ALM side of the story. They haven't done much there, so maybe he does that. But it comes back to my original point, which is he going to help develop a new technology? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Story, or is he going to go in a super evangelical role and try and explain the story? Because I also noticed that a few other of the evangelists got shoved around as well.
Yeah, they did.
And they combined, I think, the product and the people evangelism areas, so they can right. try and combine them, whereas before they've been separate. So it seems to me Microsoft is essentially, I could be wrong, is going to try and sell, make a bigger effort to sell what it's got. Now, the kind of guys they've had so far, they've been trying to get a lot of the open source developers over, making a big thing about how they've got this open source app on the platform. And, you know, that open source developer is now, you know, a willing participant in the program on Azure. But what they haven't got is the your basic ordinary Microsoft developer, the guys right. who are still building the Windows client, Windows Server,
yep.
you know, who don't really care about, never heard of an event like the O'Reilly Open Source Conference up in Portland, you know, and who would yep. never go to it. And they're the kind of guys Microsoft's been trying to get over for the last 12 months.
Right, right. So, you know, one person I talked to around the time the reorg was being put together said his theory was Microsoft was very spooked by VMware's announcement of Cloud Foundry.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, that just really, even though they're, you know, Cloud Foundry is very early and all the pieces are definitely not there yet, that is Microsoft's worst nightmare, like having a cohesive developer platform that you can point to and it has all the parts working together in one place. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's what they don't have with Azure, and that's what they need. And maybe Scott Guthrie is the guy to do that.
The problem, I mean, if Cloud Foundry is their problem, then they've already lost, because Cloud Foundry is open source. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing, because I spoke to one company in the last few days who's done an implementation of Cloud Foundry, and they're going to return the they say they're going to return the changes to the community, and hopefully it'll find it was ActiveState, who are big specialists in Perl and Python, and they're improving Cloud Foundry to make it better, easier to build and deploy and manage Perl and Python apps, and also make it easier to port your data to Cloud Foundry as well, your relational data. So if that's the case, well, I wonder, because, you know, Azure remains the fundamental entry point. The gatekeeper is the closed source nature of the code. And that's going to be the hard thing. That's going to the kind of guys who are going to Cloud Foundry are going to gain there because it's open source. Whereas you've got to have a different set of reasons to want to get onto the Microsoft cloud. You've got to believe in Visual Studio. You've got to believe in, you know, in the Windows ecosystem. You've got to have a personal affinity for Scott Guthrie to kind of, like, you know, take the edge off your objections and go, yeah, I'll give this thing a go, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, so that's going to be interesting. Moving the developer evangelists in with developer tools is a good move, I think. I was surprised those two groups weren't already together. That was kind of interesting and telling. And then one other piece I saw when I saw some of the memos was I wrote about this too, and I'm curious what you think, Gavin, about a mention about something called WinC++. Which came out in a memo that Soma wrote about the reorg, and he actually called it out separately and said, here's what we're going to do with WinC++. So the first thing was everybody asked is, what's that?
Yeah.
Right? Like, is Microsoft suddenly, like, not going to be putting all its eggs in the managed basket and going back to native? Like, what the heck, you know?
Yeah.
And even some of the people who I thought must know what Microsoft is doing there, pretty tight partners of theirs, sent me notes and said, what the heck is this? So I'm guessing it has to do with Visual Studio 2012. And it's going to be really interesting to see what that is and why they're calling it WinC++. I mean, I think it's just Visual C++ renamed, but why are they calling it out as something important and separate and worth highlighting?
I mean, a good question. If they go back, to native code, I mean, it's one of the world's largest programming languages.
It is.
Their programming base, you know, it's where they came from partly. So, they're always trying to improve languages, and I know a new version of C++ is kind of in the works as well. So, who knows? I'd be interested to see what they do. C++ running in the cloud? Don't know. It's a dynamic language world up there, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, you know, Microsoft really tried to downplay that whole reorg and say it was no big deal, just internal minor adjustments. I disagree. I think it was pretty big. And I think they don't want to alarm people because they don't want to look like, you know, their Azure house is in disarray.
Well, let's get on to our next talking point, because TechEd is rolling into town this week, and we were kind of kicking around what some of the things might be that they should talk about. And I know that one of the things that's been pretty much absent without leave has been the Windows Azure appliance. I mean, one or two other things that are in disarray, you know, you can talk about the Windows Azure appliance.
I think you called them the MIA appliance, which I agree. I call them the big-ass appliance. Does that count? Where's the big-ass appliance?
Where's the big-ass appliance? Yeah, it's been on the diet because it's not seen anymore.
It's
where is this thing? Anyway, so that's... What has gone wrong with that? I mean, they were so gung-ho about it at the partner conference last year, and now they're not even backtracking. They're just not talking about it.
Right.
And when it comes to partners,
you had a story not that long ago asking HP, like, "Hey guys, where's the Azure appliance?" And they were all like, and I'm like,
when HP had its strategy day, HP, we should mention, is one of the partners who Microsoft announced last July was going to take delivery of one of the early manufacturing models, paraphrasing again, of the Azure appliance, and then they were going to help them build it, road test it, develop it, etc.
And so the Azure appliance, we should also say what the Azure appliance is.
What is the appliance?
Yeah, so in case you've forgotten, because it's been so long since you heard about it, the Windows Azure appliance is a private cloud in a box. That's kind of like the shorthand, right? So it's a bunch of servers running Azure that customers will be able to run on-premises or have their partner run for them on-premises. Right. And you know, it kind of counteracted Microsoft's whole thing, like, nobody can run Azure except us. And then they went back and said, no, actually, you were going to let some people run Azure, just not everybody.
Yeah. So
the Azure appliances, a lot of big customers were like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And that's who it's aimed at right off the bat, are the big customers. Then just no talk about it after a while. Like, just stop talking.
It was Dell, HP, Fujitsu, and eBay were going to be the early adopters.
Right.
They get a limited production version of the appliance.
Yep.
And then they were going to develop a product, I think, and then they were going to offer services by the end of last year. Well, then nothing happened. Since then, it's come out, the Register reported that HP has pretty much built its appliance. Oh, sorry, built its cloud service. But when I asked Leo Apotheker, well, you know, we know you're doing the appliance, you had the cloud. You announced your partnership with Microsoft last year. I presume the cloud you're going to announce is based on Azure. He kind of hedged and said, we're not going to talk about it, which is a huge surprise because I was looking for basically a yes or no, and he decided to dodge. And then it's come out that they're kind of building a cloud that's going to be a support for open languages. It seems like it's going to be, you're going to have like a GUI and command line interface to work with Linux and Unix in addition to Windows. So this is not to kind of turn Microsoft's marketing phrase against them, they're not all in on the cloud, or they're not certainly not all in on the Windows Azure cloud, because it seems like if they are all in on the cloud, they're going to be using a lot of open source in there as well. Dell has told us that they're going to offer at least two clouds. One will be based on Azure, the other they're not saying. Well, Dell, FYI, is a member of the OpenStack community, building Linux for the cloud, building a kind of an open a cloud architecture for a compute and storage. Fujitsu, we're going to train 5,000 of their people on Azure. We've had nothing from them either. So, and eBay, again, not talking. So, where is it? A year this thing has been in the works. Where is it? Nothing. It seems to me that the strategy is shifting. It seems to me the technology is basically is morphing maybe at the same time as the market, and the market these days seems to be going towards the private cloud and scaling down from maybe some of the big grand ambitions they had a year ago.
Yeah. I definitely feel like there's more of a push than there was a year ago at Microsoft to try to get customers to go public cloud, which is interesting because, remember, a year ago, people like Amazon and Salesforce and VMware, they were criticizing Microsoft saying, yeah, you're just trying to get them to go to the private cloud because it's just business as usual and you can sell more Windows servers that way. In fact, people like Salesforce and Amazon called the private cloud the false cloud. Like they kept playing that up. Now we see Microsoft getting really aggressive and trying to get people to go public cloud. So if that's their new strategy, like push the customer to the public cloud, but let them still go private if they want and have a hybrid cloud and all that, what does that mean for something like private cloud in a box? Like suddenly that's not the strategy anymore. That's not what you're supposed to be pushing, right?
I'm confused. Well, I will freely admit I'm confused by this because I was reading that guy who was speaking, what's his name, Chris DeBona.
Chris DeBona, yeah.
Chris DeBona was talking at this Jeffers conference, and I took away from what he was saying that the emphasis was now on the private cloud. His words weren't exactly clear. He did a great way of not exactly saying what of giving nothing away.
He was going back and forth, like he was saying, our strategies, private cloud. No, it's public cloud. No, it's private cloud. And I'm like, wait, which is it?
So anyway, I'm gonna go with the line that they've decided. Customers are telling them, shall we say, that the private cloud, the public cloud is too rich for their blood. They're interested in the cloud, but it's private cloud, and Microsoft is adjusting. Because if you think about it, the agreements with Dell, HP, and Fujitsu and eBay last year were theoretically whether they would be then rolling out services, cloud services for their customers, which could be public clouds. But it seems to be Microsoft now seems to be considering maybe allowing the customer to run their own cloud, which in my world is a private cloud because you're not giving it over to eBay or Dell to run for you. Anyway, so they were also interesting the comparisons they made with the Oracle Exadata server, which is a whole different beast as well. So there you go, confusion. They definitely need to explain it, but I don't think they can because they're not sure what's going on.
Yeah, and what happens, the other question is what happens if your partners back out? Like, you can't do private cloud in a box without a partner, right? You need the box. Like, if you don't have HP and Dell's kind of wishy-washy and Fujitsu, yeah, maybe they're still in it. Like, okay, so who's delivering the box?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we'll see it eventually move into something like the SQL appliance that we had, because they did a lot of work there with Bull and Unisys, those guys on the Big Iron, didn't they? Would it eventually, if they're thinking in terms of putting it into an Exadata-like box, I'm not saying they are, maybe they will, that would be the natural destination for something like, for the Azure appliance, turn it into a Big Iron database server, which they've already got the SQL built into the Big Iron, and chuck the Azure Compute Fabric in it as well, and you've got something that maybe is comparable to Exadata from Oracle.
Yeah, and they've been playing up the whole data warehouse appliance, right? And the SQL Server data warehouse SKU and all that. So that would make sense.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I thought I had the answer there until you said maybe.
I know. Okay. I'm like, maybe.
Maybe not. Decision making process.
Yeah.
Sorry, Microsoft.
I think it'll be interesting to see what more is said and isn't said and is coming this year, and how far away this year it's coming, how late is it, all those things are interesting. So,
okay. Well, now, this is the question we've all been waiting for. What is Steve Ballmer's mood? Or rather, what is the state of Steve Ballmer's mind? Maybe that's the question we should ask.
What are our choices again?
Let me just pull them up. Hold on. We need to take a step back from this. Here we go. Right. The Steve Ballmer Mood Index. You have frustrated, intense, all business, victorious, and monkey boy.
You know, I'm going to say he's victorious. I felt like when I watched him at the press conference announcing Skype, he was really jazzed.
Yeah.
And even though the stock tanked afterwards, well, it didn't tank, but it dropped. I still think he thinks that they get a good deal. And I think maybe Steve Ballmer knows something we don't about what they're going to get with Skype. So I think he's victorious.
I tell you what, I looked at that webcast and I was trying to read the body language, and unless I was looking away, I didn't see Steve Ballmer looking too happy in my mind. I was sort of looking quite serious. I didn't see many smiles or grins being cracked. There was no hearty slap on the back. It was a very formal handshake between the two CEOs. They didn't look overly happy. I don't know. I'd be disappointed if I was him, because I've just announced the biggest deal in my history. As CEO in the history of the company, and Wall Street didn't bat an eyelid. In fact, everyone thinks I've paid over the odds, and now Gavin Clark in San Francisco on behalf of the register doubts my ability to cut a deal. So I'd personally be feeling maybe a little frustrated this week. I didn't get quite the reaction I thought I was going to get from it.
Yeah, maybe. I think it was funny because the day of the deal, a lot of Wall Street was panning it. Like, I was looking at the notes from Wall Street, and they were like, oh, what the heck? What are they doing? Why did they pay this much money? You know, these are the Wall Street analysts who say, why doesn't Microsoft ever buy anything? Right? And then the next day, a lot of those same analysts were like, well, you know what? Maybe it's not that bad a deal. So I don't know if it was just them trying to put a happy face on it or you know, the next day they were like, hey, maybe it's better, I don't know, instead of them sitting on all this cash. I don't know. I think Microsoft execs, the top level, are excited. And I don't think the lower levels are as excited, especially if you work on Link, Xbox Live, or Windows Live Messenger. I think you're probably nervous. And I think you'd be way more frustrated and anxious about what's going to go on with your team.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what's going to be interesting. The next few months, is going to have to explain this deal. And we've got the financial analyst meeting coming up in July. There'll be a lot of questions there about that, which will be interesting because that's around the time they're expected to talk about Windows 8 as well. I feel that a lot of the Windows 8 stuff is now going to get overshadowed by the bigger question of, like, hey, Steve, what are your plans for a Skype? Which maybe will take some of the shine off of that.
Yeah.
Well, what possibly could happen next show? We've already had so far each month we've had like a president of a major division leave. We've had like a major strategic announcement of Windows on a new computing platform. We've had a phone launch, I think, and we've had the biggest corporate deal in Microsoft's history. Surely they're going to take the next month off or so. We'll have nothing to talk about. They can't announce. There's no more news left to be had from Microsoft, surely.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. We're just starting to get into the busy period, right? The shows are just starting. And then there's Windows Next, my friend.
Windows Next. And I can't wait for this unnamed developer conference. It's going to be in September.
Exactly.
Well, until next time, I'll be holding on to my seat in my seat to see what they come up with in terms of news. This has been Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And Mary Jo Foley, editor of the All About Microsoft blog. This has been MicroByte, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.